Hi everyone, this is Chris Deasy and welcome to the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. And it was such a privilege this week to catch up from California with Sister Rose Picardi. Now Rose is based in California. She set up the Pauline Center for Media Studies. And Rose tells me how she became a film critic. She's originally from San Diego. She lives about 9 miles from Hollywood. And we talk about how faith and film have been such important influences in Rose's life. She talks about going to see The Searchers when she was 7 years of age. She's currently working on a chapter in a book for Routledge on social justice, human rights, and media literacy education. We find out why she prefers independent cinema to those, let's be honest, there are quite a few of them, quests for Jesus figures in superhero movies. We learn why The Matrix made such an impression on Rose, why meaning is made between the screen and the audience, not necessarily by what the director intends. And we discuss the role of violence and Holocaust films, how she styles her reviews. We talk about this year's Oscar winners, including Nomadland, and we find out which of the films that was nominated she hoped would win Best Picture. We talk about how Blood and Guts are Mel Gibson's signature. We find out what happened when she was invited to a screening of The Passion of the Christ in 2003, and that Mel Gibson, let's just say, didn't exactly like the advice that she gave. Rose tells us how eating her dinner before watching The Exorcist wasn't perhaps, with hindsight, a very good idea. We discuss the differences between The Nun and The Exorcism of Emily Rose, and the problems that arise when you don't have a theological consultant on board if you're making a horror film. At the end of the interview, Rose discusses how she never thought that she would end up doing what she's doing now, and she reveals how when she was diagnosed with MS back in 1997, it ended up being, she says, an amazing gift for her. And the interview finishes with a discussion of the difference between hope and optimism. It was so awesome to catch up with Sister Rose for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. Well, it is an absolute pleasure to have Sister Rose Picardi here as my latest nostalgia interviewee. And Rose, we were just saying before we started recording that for quite a while now, I'm obviously been very familiar with your writing and the videos, and particularly fascinating because we're speaking now the day after the Academy Awards. And of course, you're no stranger to the red carpet.
Yes, it happens once in a while. It's always a fun. It's always a fun event. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, do you want to just say a little bit about where you're based? Because I know, obviously, you're in California.
I am. I am in Culver City, California. And anyone who's been here, if you leave the airport and go north on the I-405, you pass right through Culver City. We're kind of surrounded by the city of Los Angeles, about 20 minutes north of the airport, LAX, and probably, depending on the traffic, actually about 9 miles from Hollywood itself. But, you know, there's only a few studios there, offices there. It's just Hollywood now. Yeah, 40 minutes to Disneyland, 20 minutes to Hollywood on a good day.
And of course, this is an audio interview, but of course, obviously, there will be a picture that accompanies the podcast. But of course, you're a sister. And of course, we were just saying that you stand out particularly on the red carpet because you don't look like anybody else who's trying to get hold of those big Hollywood stars. But of course, I've seen you with Kevin Costner. We were just talking about Clint Eastwood. So you obviously offer something very distinctive. And I'm sort of just wondering, because I don't know if you're from California originally, but do you want to just say a little bit about how you ended up where you are now?
Well, I am from San Diego. I grew up there. My family moved there when I was 6 months old. My dad was in the Navy. And so I grew up there. And when I was in high school, I started thinking about becoming a sister. And actually, when I was 11, I think was the first time I thought of it, even though I didn't go to Catholic school. But you go to religious education, you start thinking, you know, when you're in the culture, you think about these things, right? So when I was 15 and a half, I felt a very strong impulse that I really wanted to enter the convent. And so I was introduced to the Daughters of St. Paul in San Diego, who had a bookstore. We had a bookstore there then. And our work was in media, even though mostly what we did was make books and rent 16 millimeter films at the time. And film strips and things like that. But I bet people out there don't even know what a film strip is. It was that long ago, right? So anyway, I did enter the convent, finished high school, and got my bachelor's. And then when I was, let's see, it was in 1993, I went to London to the Institute of Education, which I now think is at City College London, but it was at the University of London then. And I got an advanced certificate in education because I wasn't a serving teacher, but I wanted this degree in education. So I took the same courses, and it was the Masters of Arts in Education in Media Studies. And so I spent 2 years in England, came back, got involved in our publishing house in Boston, but at the same time started our Pauline Center for Media Studies, which was started in Boston. And we just finished 25 years in Los Angeles, where we train teachers, parents, and religious educators, clergy, on how to be critical consumers of the media through a faith and social justice lens. That's basically what that is. But I got into the film thing. Oh, I always love movies, but that just starts there. And two movies in particular influenced my decision to be, you know, to follow God's call. And that was The Song of Bernadette and The Trouble with Angels. Both classic vintage films, but if anybody sees them, you'll think of, and I'm not the only sister who entered because of those films, or The Sound of Music is like the most influential for girls or young women who entered in the 60s and 70s, but entered any community. But anyway, in 1995, when I came back to Boston, got involved in our publishing house, I was asked to co-edit with Father Peter Malone from Australia, who I don't know if you've ever had him on. He's great.
Well, he was, when I was doing my PhD, his book and his, well, the chapter in the book that Clive Marsh and Gay Ortiz edited on Christ figures was one of the most influential in my academic studies.
Yes. Well, I co-edited it, and then we became co-authors on that five-volume series, the fifth one still to come out, and on scripture and film, you know, the Sunday scriptures or scripture and mainstream film. But that's like 75 or 80 films for each book. So I was thrown into the deep end. Then I moved to LA, and I was doing a blog, and I got invited to different events, screenings, press events. And then St. Anthony Messenger invited me to become their film critic in 2003. And then the National Catholic Reporter, I became a contributor on film to the National Catholic Reporter in 2009. So it's just being in the right place at the right time and loving cinema, and religion and cinema, theology and cinema. Those all things all went together for me.
Yeah, and of course, that's a similar journey for a lot of people. I think of Martin Scorsese as well, as somebody who had this great passion for cinema, but also a passion for the church. And kind of he is always said, hasn't he, that he ended up doing in filmmaking, perhaps the same kind of exploring the same sort of issues that he would have done had he become a priest. And in your case, do you even know which one came first? You know, faith or film, faith and film? Were they kind of very much sort of integral to your upbringing?
That's interesting because they certainly happened at the same time. I went to my first motion picture in a theater when I was 6 years old, and it was Christmas Day. My father, who was not Catholic, was home on leave from the Navy. So he said to my older brother, who was a year older, he was 7, I was 6, my younger brother was 5. Does he want to go to the movies? My mom is like, on Christmas Day? And so we get to choose our own movies. Open the newspaper, just choose it. So my little brother and I went to see House on Haunted Hill with Vincent Price that has no theological content that I can remember. Well, my dad and older brother went to see the Ten Commandments, which is really an odd thing, you know, that just happened. But so watching movies on TV, going up to our recreation center that we had, that was a city-sponsored recreation center, and they, for 10 cents, you could see a film. That's where I saw The Searchers for the first time. Mm-hmm. I was 7. Can you imagine seeing that film when you're 7? The John Ford, John Wayne film. That movie has become probably, I don't want to say my most favorite, but I would say for me is my most important film because of how it's been with me through my life and even through one of the first movies we were asked to write about in our media studies class. So it's just such a rich film. And especially when you look at American history, you look at racism, you look at you know, segregation that we've had in this country. That is addressed in that film. It came out just a couple years after Brown versus the Board of Education. So that's American speak, inside baseball language. But it's a very important film on many different levels, even if you take misogyny, how women are treated, and the role of manifest destiny in white people, you know, rolling west over the United States and mistreating the Indians, let's put it that way, and taking their land. So that's all in there.
Absolutely. Because I was just thinking that I was not even at university, but I went to a screening of Taxi Driver when I was only about 17 years old. And I was blown away by it. But of course, it was only subsequently that I read about how The Searchers was very integral to even down to the name, I think, of the Harvey Keitel character and all the nicknames that are used in the film and the influence of John Ford on Scorsese. So it's very funny when you grow up with a film and then you realize that the filmmakers themselves were not even borrowing, were in a way paying homage to a film from a different generation, and you've got these multiple layers which I went to the two of them in the wrong order, if you like, having seen The Searchers many years after first engaging with Taxi Driver. But it's funny, isn't it, how there are films that in a way are quality proof because you carry a piece of them with you throughout your whole of your life. And because, you know, the intersection between somebody's own autobiography and the film and the particular experience of watching it, in your case, remembering what you saw on that Christmas day in 1950 or whatever it was, 50 something, it stays with you. So yeah, 50 something rather than 1950. But isn't that interesting? And in that sense, was there a point when you thought that you wanted to engage with film scholarship? I mean, it seems that, I mean, an experience that I've always had is that you want to have a record of the films that you're watching and you want to engage with them because they're so overwhelming and you need to have some kind of data set. Peter Malone has certainly gone to town with that in Australia on Christ figures. But is that something that you felt that you were very much in need of accomplishing?
You know, at a certain point, you have to stop and take a breath. And because your output of writing, especially as a film critic, is demanding. You have to see the films, you have to write about them. And at times, especially when there's not a lot of variety out there, you just get derivative films or derivative of something else, or you get very simplistic Christian films that these wonderful publicists that you know want you to review, and they'll give you access to the actors and all this stuff. And you're going, oh, God, help me. What am I going to do? But to take the time for scholarship is really important. But sometimes I love getting an assignment. It's harder to generate the scholarship myself. So the chapter on the book that Rob Johnston edited on censorship, yes. I got the assignment, but I chose the topic because it was very important for me at that time, and it still is. But I'm going to be working on a chapter on social justice, human rights, and media literacy education for a book being done by Routledge that will be coming out. So our deadline is this summer, I think. So it's probably going to be the end of 2022, I think, when it might come out. So that's going to give me time to reflect on the films that I've seen. And even looking at the Academy Award winners this year, it was so interesting to look at human and gospel values, because some of those movies had them in abundance. So anybody who dismisses the movies this year, you haven't watched them. I don't think you really watched them.
So. Yes, and of course, this year it didn't help that so many of those films never made it to the cinema, certainly over in the UK when we're still in lockdown. And I was really delighted to see that at least The Father, which obviously won the crucial Best Actor Award for Anthony Hopkins, is going to be released in British cinemas in June. But I think all the others have already been released on streaming services. And I'm a bit disappointed about that, really. And I think on the one hand, it means that it's accessible to a wider body of people, and people have been engaging with a lot of those films already. Judas and the Black Messiah, I know, has already created a lot of interest on social media because it's been streamed already. But for you, what is the primary means of watching a film? Is it, do you still, when you can, lockdown notwithstanding, go to the cinema?
Well, let's see. The week before Easter, Palm Sunday, my sister and I went to the cinema for the first time in a year. My last movie was Emma last year. I think March 13th was, we went into lockdown on the 14th, or it was right around there. So my last movie was that Friday, and I saw Emma, and Judas and the Black Messiah was on Palm Sunday, but I haven't gone back yet. I guess I have the vaccine. We all have the vaccine, where my brother-in-law and sister, but and our community is getting it down in Los Angeles, where I'll be returning soon. But I guess I'm still a little hesitant. But when I go back to LA in May, the Landmark Theater on Pico, which is my go-to theater because they have such good quality films. They're mostly independent, and independent movies are. They seem to get at the heart of the matter. I'm tired of looking for Jesus in superhero movies. I understand, that new generations of young people coming up, these are their first experience with superhero movies. And if somebody wants to go there, go right ahead. That's not what really, I think, appeals to me so much. But I'm interested, when you're watching a movie on a screen, like a little screen, you can see a lot more. Sometimes you can see the background. I'm trying to think of what I was watching. It was so unexpected in this film, but on the wall, I was sure there was a painting of St. Thomas More, the famous one that was there. And I'm thinking to myself, why is St. Thomas More on his wall? Then I remember, however, watching Christopher Nolan's The Dark Knight. And being in the office of Bruce Wayne, and he was in his father's office, and on the wall, there was either Saint Augustine or Thomas Aquinas. I'm not, I couldn't quite make it out. I'll have to go back and look on a small screen now. But and you go, why is that there? Because there's nothing unintentional put in a frame. The directors and set producers there. I mean, they get together and everything's there intentionally. So what does that mean? It just adds to the meaning of the film.
And I found that very much with David Fincher as well. In fact, I think I regret, not regret, but I've backtracked a little bit on the extent to which I would get excited by some of these obvious biblical allusions, I should say. I remember watching, I think it was The Game, which was full of all these references to John's Gospel, and then Fight Club, which came out a few years later,
Oh my
which
gosh, yeah.
was redolent in some of these same sort of motifs. And actually, what I did think, and I tried it with my students, is that that was a really good entry point. And I think that was the crucial thing. I think rather than say, almost like in a Gnostic sense, that here we are, here's the hidden message that, this is all meant to point to something, in a sort of matrix is full of all of those. You can add up all the references and formulate some conclusion or other. I'm not interested in that. For me, what's interesting is the conversation. The conversation is more important than the idea that the film has a particular ending. I remember very disappointed sometimes when I'd come away from a film. I'm not really into all the Avengers films, but so many of my friends are, and they'd be telling you in great detail what all these films mean. And I kind of thought that you've seen the film on a different level to me, but somehow I'm not interested in the idea that the film Inception, actually, by Christopher Nolan, is another one. When people thought all these multiple layers, I was more interested in the dialogue rather than the idea that there's a definitive reading that can be ascribed to the film. But I do think that when popular films, just as you mentioned, The Dark Knight, there facilitate those sort of conversations, then I think that certainly from the point of view of engaging with students, Bohemian Rhapsody was actually an example I used. I mean, my students had never seen any of the biblical epics that I was meant to be te teaching on that particular morning in 2018 when I was delivering a class. And I thought, we're going to get through the next 2 hours with me showing clips from films that they didn't really seem to know or be interested in. But as soon as I mentioned Bohemian Rhapsody, a few of them said, oh, we saw that last night at the cinema. And then suddenly we were looking at the biblical epics and issues around hagiography through the lens of Freddie Mercury. It was a bit of an on-the-spot thing. But this whole question of why somebody's life matters matters after they've died suddenly came to life. And oddly, it wasn't planned, but it was one of the most enjoyable teaching experiences because it really connected with the students rather than have this prescribed text that they were studying because the person running the course, namely me, deemed at some point many years ago that it was necessary for them.
Yeah, well, you mentioned The Matrix, right? That was one of the most mind-blowing film experiences for me when I saw it. And that was in 1999. And I remember sitting in the theater thinking, cinema is going to change. It cannot go back from this. I was just so overwhelmed by everything in it. And now I talk to students when I sometimes do virtual guest teaching, lecturing via Zoom, and they haven't seen it. And I don't. Oh, how could you not? but they're watching what's current for them, and that'll become their texts when later on for them. But what a magnificent, rich film. And, you know, the meaning is made between the screen and the audience, right? It's not what the director intends. It's what he's telling a story. And that's the space that, as Vygotsky would say, to me, is that zone of proximal development, you know. It's where the communication between the screen and then the one receiving the film, consuming the film, has, and then afterwards has this conversation about, wow, what was that about? Not what it did, what does it mean? Well, what the movie means is important, but I'm not particularly interested in a message. Mm. You know, if you watch Mank, did you see Mank?
No, I haven't seen that yet. I know that was up, that won, I think, two Oscars, didn't it, this year?
What a snooze. But I think, I don't know if it's DeMille or who's in there, these directors are talking and they're talking about messages. And he says, look, you want to send a message, call Western Union, you know, send a telegraph. We're telling stories here. We're not sending messages. Well, it's not really true because there's always something in there, the ideology of the filmmaker. You've got, you know, the worldview comes in, but still you make your own meaning. And I think that's in the conversation. That's the great part.
And it's interesting because I'm guessing that you know the work of Robert Jewett, of course, certainly with all the Pauline work. And of course, he sadly passed away just a few months ago. But I was really interested in the debate that he had and some of the issues he had with Clint Eastwood and Unforgiven and Pale Rider and the issues around violence. And it was so fascinating to engage with a lot of that literature because of the different ways in which violence could be seen in a whole range of contexts as something redemptive or something sacramental. But I find with Clint Eastwood, his films, I mean, I was always a big Scorsese fan, but Clint Eastwood, who's still making films at the age of 90, but seems to really have his finger on the pulse. I've with The Mule, for example, there's something almost elegiac about his films and that they're tapping into something about something that's been lost or something that says something very important about maybe masculinity, but also he foregrounds female characters very, very much so. And I feel that there's a texture and a depth and even a gracefulness to his films, which I think has been consistent in all these decades of filmmaking. So are you involved in that kind of critique? Do you particularly warm to those kind of films?
Do I warm to them? I think if the story is so compelling, sure. You know, and you mentioned about sacramentality. Well, film is the external manifestation of this inner reality of the characters and of the story itself. So we access film through our senses. So there has to be this externalization of violence. I think I can't remember the quote from Flannery O'Connor, but she always said, you need enough sex and enough violence to tell the story and nothing more. You know, you not to go overboard. So I think I could take a movie like Unforgiven, where it was so awful. There's been one, I can't remember, I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the titles. There was a Holocaust film that came out. It was at the Venice Film Festival in 2019, and it was released in the US this year. And I reviewed it, and it was probably the worst, most explicit Holocaust story I'd ever seen, following a little boy from Ukraine as he crosses Europe and how mistreated he is, but terribly mistreated. And it's not even what you see explicitly. It's some, you know, what's happening off scene, off camera, off, you know, to me, you know what's happened. And I had people canceled their subscription to the magazine because I call it a work of art. And it does belong in the Holocaust canon, I think, of films that reflect on the Holocaust, because we can't forget that. So when Hitler Stole the Pink Rabbit, I don't know if it's been released in Europe. It's coming out here this month. I've seen it already. It is probably, I don't want to say a soft Holocaust movie, because it really happened. It's based on an experience by the author of the book, who did three books on being a refugee family from leaving Germany, going to France, going to England. And then I'm not sure if one of the members ended up in the United States, but it's about a young child as a refugee. But what you get is a sense of loss, a deep sense of loss as they move from place to place and they can't put down roots. And they're not treated well either, especially in Paris, you know, where the anti-Semitism was so strong. But it's probably the gentlest treatment of the Holocaust that I've ever seen. But it does add to the array of experiences. So I'm not discounting that because it's not violent. But on the other hand, you get the other Holocaust movies that are very violent. But isn't it truly the most violent thing of our memory, or of our era anyway? So I don't like violence for violence sakes, like Zack Snyder. You know, somebody said to me, what should he do in his new whatever movie? And I said, why ask? He's just going to blow stuff up. That's what he does. He blows stuff up. So anyway, what is that? That doesn't do anything for me.
Yeah.
And it's very violent. And people get up and walk away. They don't even get killed. I mean, do you know what I mean? It's kind of odd type of violence.
Yeah, and it sounds as well as though that there's a sense in which you're doing an important educative role, but also I think that there's a pastoral role in film criticism. I mean, I do very sort of amateur sort of Facebook, put them up on Facebook, because I go to the films on my own normally, and I enjoy seeing what people make of what I say. And sometimes it might spur somebody to see a film, or they might say, you know, thank you for reviewing such and such, because it was a film about which they feel very passionate. But it's interesting you say people cancelled their subscription. Do you kind of feel sometimes that when you're writing a review, you have to be very careful or very sensitive to the audience that you're writing for? Does that have a bearing on the way in which you style your reviews?
Well, so the magazine lets me review whatever I want. They let me do that. And so when it came to, I wish I could remember that name of that film, but when it came to that particular film, I asked my editor, I said, you know, this is really tough. This is explicit and tough. And he said, it's okay. You know, I think we have to tell readers, it's not like you're recommending a film because you're reviewing it. You're breaking it open. Mm-hmm. And if you take that as approval, or if you take that as a recommendation, that's on you. I'm just talking about the film. I'm trying to give a good critique for it. So, but people do what people do. And I mean, at a certain point, I'm not going to soft pedal things for my audience. But I, on the other hand, I'm not going to choose a consistent, I don't know, month, three movies a month, and they're all, you know, blood spatter on the wall. I'm not going to do that either, because I don't like those films necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, it has to work both ways, doesn't it? Because sometimes, yeah. I mean, I always find that at least if I watch a film because it's showing at the cinema, then I kind of feel, well, I don't know what I'm going to see, but I'm not going to judge the film until I've seen it. Admittedly, during lockdown, it's been a good opportunity to rewatch a lot of those 90s films that I grew up with when I was at university. And in that sense, it very much says something more about my particular type of film. And I guess in that sense, people might say, why are you watching all of these American films, or, you know, they're all English language? And often, of course, the very sort of white heroes. You think of Michael Douglas in Falling Down, or Harrison Ford in The Fugitive, or Clint Eastwood in The Line of Fire, or Bill Murray in Groundhog Day. But they're the films I grew up with. And maybe they're not films that would be made today or could be made in the same way. I mean, I'm just thinking about this year's Oscars. We were saying before we started recording that this year there have been a lot of sensitivities. And I think that the fact that it was expected that Chadwick Boseman would win posthumously the award for Best Actor. And of course, he lost to a fellow Welshman, Anthony Hopkins. But did you, in that sense, do you kind of feel that there are some big changes afoot in the in what people expect filmmakers to be doing and responding to the, as it were, the signs of the times.
Well, remember, it takes 2 to 3 years for a movie to come out. So we're seeing movies this year that were made, you know, that were finished in 2018, 2019, or they were whatever. And so what, but I look at Chloe Zhao, who did Nomadland. Her previous film was called The Rider, R-I-D-E-R. And it was about a young rodeo rider who was getting so injured, he had to discern whether he had to give it up. And he's only like 20 years old. And I'm going, I was fascinated that this Chinese born and raised woman is making films in America. And she was able to touch the heart of this family and this scenario. And then she makes Nomadland. And I'm thinking, this is a great filmmaker. She's a storyteller. And so if I think that the Academy doesn't get together on one day and talk about who they're going to vote for, you know, that isn't how it works. You know, these are individuals who, as far as I know, who are, maybe they talk among themselves, you know, independently, but I think that maybe if they don't watch the film and they just mark it off, well, it's a woman and she's Asian, so let's give her the Oscar. Maybe there's some of that going on. I don't know. But if they watch the film, this is a deserving film, even though I wanted The Sound of Metal to win.
Yeah.
But I think that she's amazing.
Yeah.
Chloe Zhao.
Yeah. So, and of course, last year after Parasite won as well. And I think that you even had, of course, the former president talking about the film. And I noticed in Britain as well, as soon as Parasite won the Oscar, suddenly its takings at the box office went sky high. And it was already on release when it won the Oscar. But then suddenly more screenings were added and people, of course, either went back for more or went for the first time. So you can see the connection. So I think with Nomadland, I think it will change the face. It may take a while to do it, but people will start to see that there are films which are not necessarily studio based, which are not like the Avengers films, which are doing very, very well critically and can therefore do well commercially. And I think that even 5-10 years ago, people didn't make that sort of connection. There was always that sense that the films that tended to do well were often films of a particular type, and that they often were very English language and either British or American. And it's very gratifying. I was so blown away by Parasite last year, and Nomadland is clearly the film to watch this year. So you've got one over me on that sense, because you've already seen it, and I can't wait for its release.
I got to see Parasite at the Cannes Film Festival because I was on the ecumenical jury there. And that was 2019. So hard to believe that it's been almost 2 years. But the overwhelming response of the audience, you know, those are citizens of Cannes get to go to those movies, and of course the critics galore. But the screening I was at was at a critic screening, and oh my goodness, they really liked it. It was amazing that it traveled. It traveled well. It's actually a brilliant film, but the violence is pretty intense. But we watch Scorsese, we watch Clint Eastwood, we watch Mel Gibson. I mean, you want to see blood and guts, watch Mel Gibson. That's like his signature. That's his signature. I don't see Clint Eastwood or Scorsese as having that as their signature. But for me, Mel Gibson chooses violence. I don't know if it's his way of exercising his own demons or what's going on there. But as an artist, that's how he chooses. That's the paintbrush he uses.
Yeah, I find it very interesting, because I remember people would say to me, gosh, it's more than 15 years ago now, almost about 17 years when The Passion of the Christ came out. And I was very conflicted about it, because I was just coming to the end of a book called Faith in Film. And I remember the editors said, well, you know, we can probably get another 10,000 words, maybe 20,000 words in here. And they said, well, The Passion of the Christ is about to be released. It was actually released that very week. This would have been Easter time in 2004. And they asked if I could, within a period of a month or so, just add this chapter. And so I had to see the film first. And so I waited to see it come out. And I engaged very much with some of the criticism. But I felt very conflicted, because I knew that on the one hand, it was the film I ought to see and must see. But it was also a film I didn't really feel I wanted to see, because it was one of those films which generated so much hype and so much division. And I also thought, how frustrating that a film like this was guaranteeing, you know, that it, there was going to be all of this concern, shall we say, raised. And so many other films were just lost. And, you know, people were not talking about some of those more spiritually profound films, those more subtle films. And I heard people also saying good things about The Passion of the Christ, when they would also be very critical of violence in other films. So it was almost as though what was okay, in because Mel Gibson had a Catholic background and he was making this Jesus film, it almost gave him a green card. And I'm not sure that I necessarily thought that that was completely okay. I don't know if you had any. I mean, I'm guessing that that was a film that you came into contact with at some point in your film reviewing history.
In 2003. I was invited to Icon Pictures in Santa Monica to a screening in a boardroom with a bunch of the LaHaye one who does the Left Behind series, Tim LaHaye, I think his name is. He was there with his wife, and there was another woman, but all these other ministers. I think I was the only Catholic there, along with the publicist who was Catholic. And Mel Gibson came in, very hyper guy. And he introduced the film. We saw it. I was overwhelmed by the violence of it. But I have to say, the conversation that happened, I think, led to them making some changes. For example, us three women who were there, we all said the same thing: over the top violence. And this is even Tim LaHaye's wife said it's over the top violence. And we just said it doesn't work for us. And I finally said to Mel Gibson, I think people might laugh. Because, you know, you laugh when you see horror to that extent, right? And he was offended. And I said, no, listen, you have to look at what the human person can take on. How much of that can you sit there and take on? Well, Jesus did it. Well, that doesn't even make sense. But what they did, if I'm remembering well, we saw it in one long piece, but they broke it up. They went from the scourging at the pillar, which was the worst part, to something else, and then came back again, went somewhere else. So the scourging was broken up, and that was actually a very intelligent thing to do, because you've got to break up the intensity. And the last thing you want people to do is laugh at it because they don't know what else to do with the emotions that they're feeling. So that I'm happy that they did that. But to me, and you can find my stuff on the internet, is that I call it a horror film. Yeah. But that's not a negative. Horror is a valid genre, right? So take the isolation, take how the cosmos is in array. You've got the crows pecking out the eyes of the thieves. You've got the children, you know, who are throwing rocks at Judas, and their eyes are bugging out of their head. And then you get the worm crawling out of Judas's nose. Okay. This stuff is showing decay. I mean, it all makes sense, and it's brilliant if you look at it as a horror film. But again, so that makes it our Catholic films horror, our horror films Catholic. And I contend that, yeah, a lot of them are.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. You think of The Exorcist, I mean, which I saw last week for the first time in nearly 20 years.
Yeah, I hope you weren't eating lunch.
I wasn't. No. Well, actually, I have to confess, I had it after my COVID vaccine, and it seemed strangely okay, because I thought somebody was joking to me and saying, well, if you're going to hallucinate after having your vaccine, have it over the Exorcist. And I was interested in the juxtaposition there, because it's done very straight. And I think Ellen Burstyn is just brilliant in that film, and it's very atmospheric. But then you've got those very gruesome scenes, which are the ones we all remember, and the ones that people laugh at. I've watched that with an audience. When I was at university, people were watching and laughing at it, and I was quite offended by the laughter, because I thought it was such a serious film. But it's a strange juxtaposition of sometimes very slow scenes, very good pacing, often scenes where there isn't very much dialogue, and then suddenly you'll have a very sort of typical horror film. In a way, it defined the genre, and then it's back to some of the slow scenes. And I thought it really worked, but I think some audiences were only interested in it for some of the scenes. The bits that I was interested interested in were kind of not the representative bit. So it felt like a very polarizing film, but it is also a film that perhaps it took me a little while to want to see all over again, because I couldn't dissociate the, if you like, the hype from some of the substance that I thought was, and of course it was a film that won, nominated for loads of Oscars in its day as well.
Yeah. And Pauline Kael, the great film critic from New York, she said that film was the best advertisement for the Catholic Church ever, you know? And I thought, what an interesting and great thing to say, because it is. And it's, you know, it's loosely based on a true story. So, and goodness, that's a reality out there. So I saw it on a Saturday afternoon. I hadn't seen it in the theaters. It came out in theaters before I was going to movie theaters. So, and by the way, I dress down when I go to movie. I don't wear my veil. I just go, I want to be a normal person. I don't want the attention to be on me. I want the attention to be on the film. That's what it deserves. And the filmmakers deserve the attention on the film. Otherwise, people are thinking, oh, that nun is seeing me watching this movie. And what's that nun doing watching this movie? I mean, it gets all, you know, confused. But I watched it by myself on a Saturday afternoon. And I'd heard about the projectile scene. And I said, oh, that's not going to happen to me. So I went and got my lunch and brought my lunch up, you know, and had my lunch in our media center in Boston. And then that scene comes on. I couldn't eat anything else after that. It was really good. I thought it was really, it's really
good. Do you
think
that you've influenced filmmakers at all? Because it sounds like, I mean, when you asked Mel Gibson that question, you said he didn't like the fact, and I assume you were dressed, you know, in your
habit. I was in my nun suit, yeah.
And it's interesting that he was offended by that question, but do you ever feel that sometimes with filmmakers that they are interested in what people like you have to say? Do you kind of feel that, because I've met a few filmmakers in my time, often at jury, and I've been on an ecumenical jury, but I think three times now in my time around different European film festivals. But do you feel sometimes that they're amenable to that kind of discussion? Do they sometimes like to reflect on what their films are doing and how audiences are engaging with them? Or do you kind of feel sometimes that it's a case of it's their product and they like it, obviously, if you say good things about it? But do they really want to hear what you have to say about their films?
If they invite you into a pre-screening, you know, pre-release screening, yes, they do. They're not going to invite you if they don't want the truth or what you really think about it. Sometimes you might, you might ask, can I send an email after where you could be a little bit more detailed or something like that. But I've been to a few pre-release screenings and for feedback, and it wasn't me alone. It would be with others, you know, and we would give our feedback. And so I got my first producing credit coming out, the film Francesco that is on Discovery Plus now. I don't know if it's been released in Europe yet or what platform, but it's a documentary and I'm associate producer for that. So all along the trajectory of the film, I was able to give feedback. I don't know how many times I watched it and to check translations to make sure the English was good, was really on point. Because I remember one film, it said that Catholics worship Mary. It was a good film. It was a very good Catholic film. And I said to the Mexican producer, I said, about Our Lady of Guadalupe, I said, you can't use that word. You have to change that. You must change it to honor, because only God is worshiped. And it was too late. So whoever they hired for to do the subtitle work, they didn't really have anybody look at it after. I think they learned a lesson after that. So anyway, yeah, I think when they ask you in early, they really want, because they don't want to misstep either. They might not do what you say, but they take it on board.
And I suppose the same question can come from the point of view of the church in that sense. Is there a perception that there are certain films that you will talk about? Do you kind of feel sometimes that people are surprised that you might go to a cinema dressed as an ordinary person and go to see Exorcist type films? Do you find sometimes that people are not expecting you to like or certainly to talk about some of the films that you do? Because I have all of those stereotypes. People make all sorts of assumptions about the fact that I'm a theology lecturer. People make all sorts of assumptions sometimes about the sort of thing that I do, and maybe are surprised sometimes that I engage not just with film, but with very specific films, which in some ways are quite the antithesis of who I am. In other words, I love Scorsese's films, but in a way, I what really draws me to them is the fact that it's an entry point into a different world, and it's the sensitive way and very powerful way which he does it. So I don't sort of watch Travis Bickle or Max Cady and think, you know, I'm like them. In a way, I find it fascinating as character studies, but I need that screen to be there between me and them. I admire what Scorsese does, but I'm also glad I don't live in the world that he's so brilliantly delineating. But what's your sense? Also, living in California, there must be a sense that, you know, to be right at the heart of the movie capital of the world, while also being such an important figure within the Catholic Church.
Well, I'm not sure how what my place might be in that universe of the Catholic Church and film reviewers. I mean, I still have a job, let's put it that way. So, but because I know some people they disagree with my takes very much. But you know, if you take the movie Soul, the animated film Soul, you know, that has every religion in the world can find themselves in there. But it wasn't their job to make a movie that I agreed with in every minute. But what I found in that movie was life is worth living, that there's a purpose, you know, there is a purpose. Did you see Soul yet?
No, I have. No, hasn't. No, I think it has come out here on streaming services not too long ago.
It's so brilliant. It's just so brilliant. But anyway, to go back to your question, I went to what they call a recruited screening. I don't know if they have them in England. But they'll stand outside of a theater and they'll give out free tickets to films that haven't been released yet because they want to get the audience's reaction. So I went to a recruited screening for the film The Exorcism of Emily Rose by my friend Scott Dickinson. He's a great guy. And so I walked in the theater with this gentleman. I went with this gentleman who is a member of Catholics in Media because we had two tickets. And so we went in and everybody turned around and looked at me and they go, "Yay, sister." And I don't know what came over me. I said, "Anybody want a blessing?" And they all went, "Yes," because it was an exorcism movie. They went there to be scared. Wes Craven said that one time, people go to scary movies because they're scared already and they like to be scared. Yes. But they also, because what it can take is your fear and has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And it kind of gives you a control over the frightening things in your life. That's the other thing about horror films. But it was just the reaction. And then I got to go to Mexico City for the international press junket for the film The Nun. That horror film, did you get to see that?
Yeah, I've seen that. And I saw The Exorcism of Emily Rose. I'll tell you my thoughts in a minute, but I want to hear, want to hear your story.
They flew us for 3 nights in Mexico City, and at the Ritz, we had a butler on our floor. That was probably the last hurrah as far as international film junkets go. But so all the events took place outside of Mexico City at night, up at this old monastery that's now a national park, a federal park, as they call it in Mexico. And there we were. They created all this scary stuff, but we were in this big room to watch the film, and I had taken this little bottle of holy water because I said, I wonder if this is going to work with these guys the way it worked with The Exorcism of Emily Rose, because I think I'm the only clergy person there, if you will. So I stood up before the film began. I said, anybody want some holy water? And they all went, yes. So I just sprinkled it around. But It was fun. But on the other hand, they kind of know that they're going to be watching something that deals with a world that we don't seem to inhabit very often. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, and my sense with The Nun is that it was almost as though it was a case of what are the things that will make people jump out of their seats, and that was the starting point for the film, and it didn't feel there was anything else sort of to undergird it. So like a succession of chills. The Emily Rose film, that was remarkable because it was so creepy and believable, and it was like deconstructing that very horror. It was almost as though Tom Wilkinson, actually, who's an alumnus of the university where I work, he's so good in it because, as with The Exorcist, it's a case of playing up the doubts and the incredulity around it, the superstition or the so-called mumbo jumbo, and that really worked, and it felt like a really sensitive film. It takes the audience with you. With The Nun, you kind of feel that if you're susceptible to those sort of charms, those sort of shocks, it'll work for you. But otherwise, you kind of feel that the film is just very much by the numbers.
Okay, that's a really perceptive insight. So at the press day that followed the screening, I got to talk to the director, and he's a young British guy. He's a really nice young man. He was there with his wife and his two little kids at the hotel. I saw them the next morning at the hotel. But what a really nice man. But this is my question always to these exorcism movies. So, did you have a theological consultant, or did you just watch all the other devil movies? And you know what he said? Just watch the other devil movies. Yeah. And I saw his sketchbook because I think he did his own storyboards, brilliant artist. And you know, it was all well done. But they also use that the falsehood that if you commit suicide, you can't be saved, you can't be buried in a Catholic, a blessed in blessed consecrated ground. And that's been since the 40s that that has been, you know, demolished in Catholic teaching, shall we say. It's said, no, that's not true, because, you know, anyway. So they always use that. They can't get away from that. It's like, and then you don't take a novice in training and send her off to Transylvania with a priest she doesn't even know, and they're there. The other thing is, they really need to use flashlights and work during the day. Is there some reason why? It's like, don't open that door. Are you kidding? Anyway, yeah, it gets a little campy. I thought it was a little campy.
Yeah, and I saw it with an audience at a multiplex, and they were most. I was probably the oldest person now. I mean, I'm in my mid 40, well, 47 now. I was probably about 44, 45 when it came out, and I was clearly a lot older than the other people who were there. And of course, they were throwing popcorn, and some of the boys who were there were winding up some of the girls who were there, and if anybody did scream, then they were laughing at them. And so actually, I don't think I was so much watching or reviewing the film. It felt that I was watching the audience, and I also felt it was an audience I didn't want to be in. And I found that with Jojo Rabbit, I saw it in the same cinema, and people were laughing. And we were talking about Holocaust films just now, and I thought people were laughing at some very bad taste comedy. But then I saw the film again because people who thought that my review was too harsh, encouraged me to see it again, and I saw it at a different cinema with a much sort of older sort of audience, and I was really moved by it. So it's funny how sometimes the setting, the audience, the people around you can have a bearing on the film, and that's why sometimes I do think it's important to revisit films. Often life's too short, but if possible, to see films on multiple occasions and just to sort of carry a bit of that film with you, because I do think sometimes that the particular, almost the biographical circumstances around the film can very much impact on the way in which you see it.
No, I think that's so true. And we play off of each other. And that's the beauty of going to the cinema, you know, because you were with people. But then the downside is, like you say, can be rather distracting. It can be. I haven't had that happen. I guess because I go to theaters where, well, the Landmark is going to be mostly an older crowd. So because it's just the films that they like to see, that you know, that I like to see. And I have some great conversations walking out of the theater after, just saying, well, what did you think about this? And some of these folks are willing to stand there and chat a little bit. And that's a nice thing to do. I think that's a good thing to do.
Yeah. And I've got a few more questions as we start to wrap up, Rose. One would be, could you ever have imagined that you'd be doing what you're doing now all those years ago? I mean, did you ever sort of look back and just think, how did I end up here? Or was this always something that you hoped would be your vocation?
Never imagined it in a million years. It just, these are opportunities that came, and I think as a result of my degree in London that, you know, gave me so much the ability or the skills to critique in a more human way, in a more, and I'm going to say values way, but when I say values, I mean the authentic human values that, you know, integrity, honesty, care for the earth, things like that, that keep us going as people. A family, community, solidarity, these are all great values for me that I look at. And I think those are the values of the gospel as well. But, you know, coming off that degree, that's what gave me the confidence, I think, to start writing. You know, AOL had just been born, America Online. I get home and I get a computer and I get the internet like right away. And they had a journal and I started reviewing films. They don't have it anymore, but that was my first attempt at reviewing films just because I like them. I love them.
That's the way it works, that you can never imagine looking back that you'd be doing what you're doing, but there's also a part that feels it's inevitable that, you know, you I feel that way, that somehow I would, you know, I'm a big diary writer as well, but I also feel that sometimes, you know, I was, you know, almost like predestined to do some of the things that I do. It's funny because you don't always have a control over it. You know, I have to write a review of a film or so on, and the passion and the need to disseminate it and share that, whether with students or with peers or family members, I think is quite intoxicating sometimes.
I had a life event happen to me though that kind of made this a possible, and that is I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis in 1997. So I was no longer able, I'm mobile, I can travel, that's not a problem, I have balance issues and fatigue, but I can't stand, I can't walk far, and I can't stand, my muscles don't work. And so I was no longer able to work in our bookstores. We have bookstores even in England, the Pauline Book and Media Centers. And so that had been my work until I went to England. And so when I came back, I said, you know, what am I going to do with this degree? And that's where I devised our Pauline Center for Media Studies, even before I came back, because I was already invited to go back a year later to talk to seminary heads and people in formation of novices and things like that. So I needed an auspices from which to go, you know. But it was multiple sclerosis that turned out to be an amazing gift for me. Mm-hmm. And that not everybody will say that. And it took me a long time to get there, to realize that this is going to work, and it has worked for me. It's been a blessing in disguise with a lot of limitations. But when opportunities came, I was able to accept them because I was available.
Yeah, well, actually, I was going to ask, funny enough, my next question was going to be in the context of nostalgia, whether it's possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences. And I think you've hit the nail on the head that sometimes something that it can be a blessing in disguise, but you've got to be careful how you say that, because some people might think no. I remember a famous politician in Britain who lost his wife didn't die, but she was significantly injured in an IRA bombing back in the 1980s, and he sort of, you know, always took the line there that's just the most horrible thing that could happen, and you can't use the language of redemption in that sort of context, and that's very understandable when somebody's been through something so harrowing. But I also think it's really interesting sometimes that the things that propel us, the things that make us do what we do, whether it's going to see a film or reviewing a film or in often the research that we do, comes out of something that we can't comprehend, something that is so horrible sometimes that the only way to deal with it is sometimes to channel it into, and it might be writing, there are other forms of communication and dissemination, but I think that you've hit the nail on the head that sometimes those negative experiences, if we don't try to make sense of them or channel them in some way, that then sometimes they'll just eat us up.
That's certainly true, because nobody around me had any chronic disease like that. We have sisters with cancer and things, but not like a chronic brain dysfunction that at any minute, you know, something could happen. And so I belong to this group with about 20,000 people on it that is multiple sclerosis people. And people who are newly diagnosed are so lost, and they feel the same way I did when I was first diagnosed. It took a while for me to befriend, if you want to use those words, this negative experience. But now I see it as an odd kind of gift. Thank you, God. you know, so yeah, it's made me available to do things that otherwise I wouldn't be able to do, maybe have never done.
Yeah. And indeed, my very last question is whether you would consider yourself, Rose, to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person.
Wow. I look back in the sense that I love stories. And so I'm working on biographies of all the sisters of our United States province who have died since our province began. I knew all of them with except maybe two, because I entered and they were still kind of young. So in that sense, I look back for the wisdom. I look back for inspiration. Sometimes I look back in anger because you know, you have things in your life and things make you remind you of it. And you're going, you know, but then I would rather look forward. I would rather look ahead, and I'm a big planner, except when it comes to calendars, sometimes I get mixed up, but I do like to look ahead in hope. And that might be an optimistic part of me, but hope is different from optimism. Hope is rooted in faith, I think, and love, and that even if it's on a human level, it's something that can carry you forward, where optimism can get, I don't know, you can run out of optimism. But hope will sustain you. I think that's what I look at.
Well, Rose, it has been so tremendous to have you on my podcast. Thank you so much for being my guest this week.
Oh, and thank you so much, Chris, for your perseverance and for this lovely, lovely opportunity. God bless you.